The Torah content from now through Pesach has been sponsored by the Kofsky family in loving memory of Adira, who loved big ideas and asking big questions.
Hello, I'm Rabbi Matt Schneeweis, and this is the Stoic Jew Podcast, where we explore the relationship between Judaism and Stoicism. Today, we're going to do something a little bit different. I was taking a walk down memory lane and thinking about the first time I met Epictetus, and as it so happens, I have a transcript of that meeting. And by transcript, I mean that I met Epictetus in a book, and I have a passage from that book. The book is The Gift of Fire by Richard Mitchell. If you have been my student in real life, or if you've read my blog, then you'll know that I am a huge fan of Richard Mitchell as a writer, and The Gift of Fire in particular. I would definitely count this book as one of the top 10 most influential books in my life, at least as far as nonfiction, non-Torah writings go. And I was thinking about the fact that I read this book. I don't know the exact month, but I'm pretty sure I read this at the same time that I met Rabbi Moskowitz and got my first exposure to thinking and to philosophy and to Mishlei. So we're talking like, you know, at the start of everything here, okay? And I would love you to just read the entire book, but obviously I can't do that on a podcast. So I figured I would just read the part where I was first exposed to the core of Epictetus's Stoicism. So before we do that, let me just set the stage. I'm going to read the first paragraph of Epictetus's Enchiridion, the handbook, which I've read countless times on this podcast. And I'll focus on the very, very last line, but I want to read the whole paragraph. On the one hand, there are things that are in our power, whereas other things are not in our power. In our power are opinion, impulse, desire, aversion, and in a word, whatever is our own doing. Things not in our power include our body, our possessions, our reputations, our status, and in a word, whatever is not our own doing. Now, things that are in our power are by nature free, unhindered, unimpeded, but things not in our power are weak, slavish, hindered, and belong to others. Remember, therefore, that whenever you suppose those things that are by nature slavish to be free, or those things that belong to others to be your own, you will be hindered, miserable, and distressed, and you will find fault with both God and men. If, however, you suppose to be yours what is yours, and what belongs to another to belong to another, as indeed it does, no one will ever compel you, no one will hinder you, you will find fault with no one, reproach no one, nor act against your own will, you will have no enemies. And here's the line, and no one will harm you, for no harm can touch you. So this is where Epictetus makes the promise of invulnerability. I think I actually made an episode with a title like that, that no harm can touch you, okay? Now, on the surface, that sounds crazy, and that's what Richard Mitchell is going to talk about. But the version of this idea that I like the most is really in Marcus Aurelius' Meditations 4:8, where he says, what does not make a man worse than he was, neither makes his life worse than it was, nor hurts him without or within. In other words, harming you, the only way you can be harmed is if you are made into a worse person, okay? And this is what Richard Mitchell is going to talk about here, okay? What I have done here is I've selected he talks about Epictetus throughout the book, but what I've done is I've selected the part that is the most, I guess where he talks about it the most, and I kind of edited it a little bit. I took out parts that were not directly relevant to this point. And this is part of the book itself is about what true education is. So this is really the second to last chapter, culmination of his argument. But I think I can safely excerpt this part and you'll get an insight into how I first encountered Epictetus. And again, this is an unusual episode because I'm basically going to be reading this and just share my thoughts at the end, but there's a lot here. And something that I think, you know, your first impressions of something make a big impression, duh. But what I mean is that had I been exposed to Epictetus in a different way, I don't know if it would have landed. You know, I think it would have, especially because I had not been exposed to thinking at all. I had read about Epictetus in the context of a philosophy class or just a book of philosophers, or if I just picked it up on the shelf, I don't know if I would relate to it the way that I ended up relating to it based on Richard Mitchell here. And really for this, I have Dr. Jones to thank. Dr. Jones was my English teacher, my best English teacher ever, and he's the one who assigned this book and prompted thinking about it. Okay, so without further ado, here is an excerpt from the second to the last chapter of The Gift of Fire. We are inclined to reject as simply preposterous a notion of Epictetus which holds that nothing bad can happen to a good person. We have plenty of evidence to the contrary, ranging from flat tires and toothaches at one end of the scale to death and destruction at the other. Toothaches and flat tires, some of us may actually escape, but not death and destruction. Death and destruction, however, which are the natural destinies of all creatures and things, are not the killers and destroyers, and it is a strange understanding of the world by which we think of the former as bad as the latter. Stranger still, we actually take comfort from believing that since we are regularly victims of what we call bad, then we must be good, and the good and the innocent. To be stricken with a lethal disease, therefore, is to be persecuted by an implacable and irresistible tyrant, and the sufferer wins not only sympathy, but moral approbation, as the aggrieved party in an unfair proceeding. He seems, all guiltless, to have been condemned. Therefore, he must be the just party to this transaction. That a bad thing has happened to him proves him one of the good people. It is as though sickness and every other condition of suffering were a vast prison in which every single prisoner has been given a bum rap, unjustly accused, unlawfully convicted, and sentenced to death. Epictetus was doing no more than reaffirming, simply and literally, a very old idea. He could see no sense at all in presuming the existence of goodness or badness where there was no intention, no will. He knew that people fell sick and died, and that they maimed and killed each other routinely, either in the name of the law or out of it. He was not a childish dreamer who imagined that the good, if only they believed something or other with all their hearts, would somehow be magically protected from the natural processes in the world and in themselves. He knew, and anyone can, through nothing more than a little reflection, that it comes to pass with the good, meaning the good people, exactly as it comes to pass with the bad. Chance and the world happen to them all. And it is the same whether we imagine that the world includes inordinately touchy gods who take revenge for affront, or implacable diseases lying in wait for those who don't eat enough fiber. But I suspect that for Epictetus, the question was not how to escape the gods or the diseases. It was rather how to remain a good person when stricken by either, as we all must be in one way or another. To be sick or to suffer is inevitable. But to become bitter and vindictive in sickness and suffering, and to surrender to irrationality, supposing yourself the innocent and virtuous victim of the evil intentions of the world, is not inevitable. The appropriate answer to the question, why me, is the other question, why not me? Those who can ask the first must have already devised some answer to the second, however unconsciously and incoherently. It is the most important implication of Epictetus' strange assertion that a good person would know better than to devise that answer, an answer that would have to be irrational, setting the deviser above or beyond the natural order in which life takes place. The curious proposition of Epictetus can be easily understood in the simplest of examples. I find myself once again in the toll booth line, the shortest one, into which I have audaciously and cunningly found my way, and actually escaped this time serious injury or even death, while also this time failing to visit either on other drivers. I am, of course, going somewhere. My mission, unlike that of the woman ahead of me, is important. Much, much will depend on my timely arrival at my important destination, where those who await me will be able to do nothing, nothing at all, without me. Richard Mitchell's a teacher, by the way. I have already asked the usual question, why me? Now I am busy trying to provide a convincing answer to the neat question, why not me? I have made and accepted my own version of the natural order of things and actually supposed a universe that has, or damn well ought to have, my convenience in mind. And there she sits, pawing all in vain through 18 pounds of purse. Harm is being done. Notice that I have cleverly put this in the passive, a traditional and convenient way of suggesting that there can be a deed without a doer and a harm without a harmer. But harm, real harm, truly is done. A badness has been brought into being, and there is an agent of harm. A person who could choose either to do it or not has done it. I am that agent. There is no other possible agent in sight. The changeless woman is, in this case, as utterly without intentions as the rain that might fall before I reach that stupendously important destination. Should that happen, will I blame the rain and fume at the great order of things, which is obviously against me? In this context, of course, such a reaction seems preposterous, even ludicrous, in fact, hardly to be believed. But an honest inventory of the past compels me to notice that I have, quite contrary to what seems just now nothing but simple good sense, occasionally done such a thing. Others have too, I think. How strange. The event, perhaps, is trivial. The condition it brings is not. It is supremely important. It is a temporary destruction of a person, and for all I know, a harbinger of a permanent destruction, a lifelong absence of self-rule. Can such a condition be possible?
If I fail to take it seriously because of the supposed triviality of the event, which I have already taken seriously enough to bring about my own derangement. Oh, sorry, I didn't mean to quote that part. Okay. Ancient thinkers who spoke of necessity with a capital N meant that the world does not have to be the world that it is, that all things are subject to principles by which they are what they are and by which they also become inevitably what they become. In that understanding, there is no possibility of escape from necessity, of course, but even more important, there is no good to be taken or supposed in the escape from necessity. Far from it. For the dream of escape from necessity, of special dispensation from the order of the world, is a lie about the world. When I fume in the tollbooth line, I am not a good person to whom a bad thing is happening. I am a liar who is getting what he deserves. Okay, that's the end of the excerpt. So I don't know about you. I mean, I'm reading this. I used to read this every couple of years. I need to get back into that habit. I am just bowled over by how many fundamental ideas are in just this one excerpt, fundamental ideas that have formed the foundation of my relationship with Michelet, with Coheles, with EO, with Stoicism, with philosophy in general, with thinking, with education. You know, the idea of I did not realize that this is the first place that I heard the retort of the why me being the question of why not me. You know, I didn't realize that this was the first place where I got the idea that when another human being is doing something that annoys you, then you have to ask yourself, like, if this were the rain, would I fume at it and get mad and blame this this entity, or would I accept that this is just the necessary order of things? You know, I didn't realize that this was the first place where I encountered the idea that the suffering that we have comes from ourselves, and that comes from what he calls a lie, you know, a distorted way of viewing the world that we tell ourselves. I mean, there's so many ideas here that I encountered in this book. And again, the remarkable thing is I encountered this at the same time that I was encountering Michelet and Rabbi Moskowitz and thinking and Torah really for the first time. I mean, I got to ask Dr. Jones when this was, but this was my guess is this was sometime around November or December of my 11th grade year. And so really all of these ideas I encountered all these, I almost said all these ideas encountered me. I encountered all these ideas at the same time. And they really just, took root. Like seeds, they landed on the soil, the fertile soil of my mind, and were nurtured by my teachers, and then ended up growing into a lot more fruitful entities here. So I this is a weird episode because I mostly just read. I didn't really talk about anything, but I just felt like when I was reflecting on this that I had to share it because it's a great explanation of Epictetus, but it's also a window into where I'm coming from, really. So maybe this is just a selfish endeavor, but what is this podcast if not a selfish endeavor that happens to benefit people who find benefit in it? So that's it. If you've gained from what you've learned here today, please consider contributing to my Patreon at www.patreon.com/RabbiSchneeweis. Alternatively, if you would like to make a direct contribution to the Rabbi Schneeweis Torah Content Fund, my Venmo is @Matt-Schneeweis, and my Zelle and PayPal are MattSchneeweis@gmail.com. Even a small contribution goes a long way to covering the cost of my podcast and will provide me with the financial freedom to produce even more Torah content for you. If you would like to sponsor a day's or a week's worth of content, or if you are interested in enlisting my services as a teacher or tutor, you can reach me at rabbischneeweis@gmail.com. Thank you to my listeners for listening. Thank you to my readers for reading. And thank you to my supporters for supporting my efforts to make Torah ideas available and accessible to everyone.